Greetings, I'm Bob McChesney. Welcome to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're coming to you live this December 23rd, 2007. We've got a terrific show waiting for you today, one that I've been looking forward to for a long time, and one I think you're going to enjoy a great deal. But before we go to our guest, our mystery guest, so to speak, let us first go to Media Minutes and get an update on what's going on in the world of media politics.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
If I could ask for everyone who supports the item to signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The item is adopted. The item is adopted. And
the public does not want more consolidation. We want more democracy.
And we'll take...
On December 18th, the Federal Communications Commission voted to remove the long-standing newspaper broadcast cross-ownership ban that prevents a newspaper from owning TV and radio stations in the same market. The protest from members of the peace group Code Pink inside the FCC was a small example of the widespread public outcry against the decision across the country. Martin unveiled a proposal last month to open up the top 20 markets to cross-ownership. His new rules, which were riddled with loopholes, were widely criticized, and the FCC was hauled up to Capitol Hill for oversight hearings in both the House and the Senate.
Are you aware that Dean Singleton of the Media News Group said that the newspaper industry is, quote, very, very, very profitable, and it will continue to be for a long time?
First study excluded Latinos. It was a study on how people receive their news. Excluded Latinos. Wouldn't that be a flaw in the study?
In sum, the FCC appears to be broken.
There's a lot of loopholes. The language is very mushy.
My folks in Seattle believe that they were treated like a bunch of chumps.
I just can't express the level of my frustration.
The two Democratic commissioners, Michael Copps and Jonathan Edelstein, strongly dissented. Copps said that Martin's plan would have made George Orwell proud.
Today's story is a decision by the majority, unconnected to good policy and not even incidentally concerned with encouraging media to make our democracy stronger. We're not concerned with gathering valid data, conducting good research, or following the facts where they lead us.
Copps also took issue with the process that produced the new rules. From short notice for public hearings to last-minute revisions made in the middle of the night before the vote.
Finally, at 1:57 this morning, we received a new version of the proposed test for allowing more newspaper broadcast combinations. I cannot claim that I fully appreciate the test's finer points, given the lateness of the hour, and the fact that there was no time afforded to parse the finer points of the new rule. But this much is clear, the new version keeps the old loopholes and includes two new ones. This is not the way to do rational, fact-based, and public interest-minded policymaking.
The late changes Martin made to the proposal ended up making the rules even worse than advertised. With no advanced warning, the chairman also granted waivers to 42 existing newspaper broadcast combinations.
Yet this late-night decision will affect the people of these communities and many others for years to come on a daily basis. In light of these nocturnal events, anybody who thinks our processes are open, thoughtful, or deliberative should think twice.
But the fight is not over. Congress, public interest groups, and citizens across the country are ready to fight the ruling. Craig Aaron, Communications Director of Free Press, explains what will happen now.
The day before the vote, 26 senators got together and sent a letter to FCC Chairman Kevin Martin telling him that if he went ahead with his vote on December 18th, despite all the public opposition, despite all the warnings from Capitol Hill, that they would take action to nullify this vote. And Senator Byron Dorgan has already given a speech on the floor of the Senate saying he'll do just that. There are co-sponsors lined up to either pass the Media Ownership Act or pursue what's called a resolution of disapproval, which is a rarely used congressional veto that could throw these rules out. In order for these rules to be passed and to be put into law, we're going to need people from across the country to contact their members of Congress to rally support for this crucially important legislation to reverse what the FCC has done this week and make sure that the public airwaves actually serve the public.
Aaron says that if Congress fails to act, the fight will be taken to court.
Kevin Martin will not have the last word on these rules. There's no question that the public interest community is going to challenge what he's done here, both on the substance of the rules and on the broken and corrupt process that produced them.
For more information about the FCC ruling, go to stopbigmedia.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is University of Illinois Law Professor Francis Boyle, now approaching his fourth decade on the faculty here at the University of Illinois Law School. Francis Boyle is a Harvard PhD in political science as well as a law legal degree from Harvard, attended the University of Chicago as an undergraduate, has written widely on international law, is an acclaimed expert on the area. Go Google him on the web and you will be blown away by his accomplishments. He has many books and articles to his credit. Most recently, and the one we'll be talking about today, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law, just out through Roman and Littlefield. Welcome to Media Matters, Francis Boyle.
Well, Bob, thanks for having me on, and my best to your listening audience.
Oh, thank you very much. And I think when I look at your career and the work you do, Francis, it really makes me realize this is why we have tenure, because you know, you have really been willing to take on tough issues and stick by your principle. In a way, regrettably, I don't think it's necessarily all that widespread. And
I think that's correct. I've had two law school deans trying to fire me and others starving me of funds. So without tenure, I would have been out of here probably 25 years ago. Right.
Okay, well, this is the case for today's show could be subtitled The Case for Tenure. I guess people don't like you, The Case for Not Having Tenure. We'll soon find out. You know, your expertise is in international law in the U.S., and you're quite critical of the U.S. record with regard to adhering to international law and treaties. You know, I want to go into your new book and your argument, but let's take this opportunity to just walk people through what international law is, how it applies to the United States, some of the basics of how it operates.
Right. Well, in my new book, I deal with the principles of international law applicable to the conduct of warfare by the United States government. This book was conceived shortly after the wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. And unfortunately, I concluded that we were in for a long haul on both these wars, if not more wars. And so at a minimum, I should get a book out there that deals with the whole complex of legal issues related to warfare, international law, constitutional law, human rights law, military law. Mm-hmm. So they're all in there. But to make a long story short.
You can make it long here. Make it medium.
The United States Constitution, Article 6, determines that treaties are the supreme law of the land, such as the Geneva Conventions, which the Bush administration has grievously violated in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib in Iraq and elsewhere, the United Nations Charter, a war of aggression against Iraq that clearly violated the UN Charter, the Nuremberg Charter, an executive agreement, again, violated against Iraq. And then customary international law, which the United States Supreme Court held in a very famous case, Packet Habana, arising out of the Spanish-American War, that international law, customary international law, is part of United States domestic law.
What does
and
customary
must be obeyed.
Mean?
It's very similar to Anglo-American common law, which some of you might be familiar with, torts, criminal law, property, Many areas of our legal system simply have not been incorporated in statutes, mm-hmm. and judges rule based on prior precedent. So customary international law is analogous to common law. Right.
So, you know, you talk about Article 6 of the Constitution saying, in effect, treaties we sign on to supersede domestic laws. I mean, they are the law of the land for the United States. And you argue in your book and in your research that the United States has not done a really bang-up job of adhering to these treaties and complying with them. And I want to go through some of the evidence you have in the case you make. But one of the first things that I hear people say as soon as that argument's made is, well, you know, the bad guys don't either. The other side that we're fighting, whoever our enemy might be at the time, going back to the Nazis and then the Soviet Union and the Cold War and all the terrorists, at least they're violating international law right and left. So can we really effectively contend with them in this sort of global struggle if we play by the rules of the Marquis of Queensberry and these guys don't play by any rule book at all?
Right. That argument actually came up with respect to the Nazis when Stalin wanted to take out the top 50,000 Nazi leaders and shoot them. And Churchill wanted to take out the top 5,000. Mm-hmm. But the United States government took the position that, well, then what separates them from us? Mm-hmm. And why did we fight this war? So we insisted on a tribunal, Roosevelt and Truman, and due process of law. And which they were given at the Nuremberg Tribunal and also in the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal. Mm-hmm. And at Nuremberg, by the way, not everyone was convicted and not everyone was sentenced to death. And yet today, unfortunately, we have – and this book basically is focusing on the policies of the Bush administration, but with historical background. We have the United States government officials – publicly proclaiming and adopting arguments that were made and rejected at Nuremberg by the lawyers for the Nazi defendants. For example, preventive warfare. The Nazis made that argument, mm-hmm. and it was rejected at Nuremberg. We had a judge there, the chief prosecutor, Mr. Justice Jackson, who took a leave from the U.S. Supreme Court. We drafted the Nuremberg Charter. And so if you go back, and I document this in my book, you will see, regrettably, apparently, lawyers and officials in the United States government who are unaware of the precedents that we set at Nuremberg. And these precedents then, by the way, were incorporated into the field manuals by United States Armed Forces, where they are still there today. For example, U.S. Army Field Manual 27-10 on the laws of land warfare, which I deal with quite extensively in my book. It is still valid, still binding in the field. It expressly incorporates all the Nuremberg principles, and it was drafted for the Pentagon by mm-hmm. my teacher of the laws of war at Harvard Law School, mm-hmm. The late, great Richard R. Baxter, who, by the way, helped me get my job here because he was my teacher. I was one of his top students while there. So this is law also accepted by our military in their manuals. So the notion that somehow the United States of America, which is the oldest constitutional democracy in the world today, should govern our behavior by the Nazis or the KGB, or Al-Qaeda, I just find unconscionable.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Francis Boyle, University of Illinois law professor, author of the brand new book, which we're talking about, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law, a book that has received some exceptional reviews from and early comments from readers on it that I have the privilege to look at. And today is a pre-recorded show, so please sit back, relax, let us do the talking. And we've got a lot to talk about here. Francis Boyle, you know, the war on terror has become sort of the World War III or World War IV, pick your world war. That's the defining theme in the United States is we're now at a permanent war that's going to last forever until we eliminate the terrorist threat to the United States. And you had a famous exchange immediately after 9/11 with Bill O'Reilly on the Bill O'Reilly Factor Show, whatever it's called on Fox News, in which you argued that war is not the proper way to understand the battle with terrorism. Explain what you meant by that.
Sure. What happened on September 13, 2001, Fox called me up and asked me to debate O'Reilly that night on war versus peace. He would argue for war, and I would argue for a peaceful resolution of this matter.
You were meant to be the Washington Generals.
Well, I was supposed to be arguing for a peaceful resolution and not going to war.
Yeah.
And you can find the transcript of the debate on counterpunch.org. Jeff St. Clair, Alex Coburn put it on there. And what I pointed out, and indeed I've debated terrorism, I've litigated cases of terrorism, I've dealt with military officers on terrorism. This is a problem of international domestic law enforcement, and that is the way it should be treated. I believe that is the most effective way to deal with it. And what we have seen is the Bush administration, which until that point had been a failed presidency, jacking up the stakes and trying to turn this into World War III in order to distract attention from everything else and ram its neoconservative agenda through Congress, through the media, which they have done quite successfully. For example, these hearings by General Petraeus on Iraq, scheduled deliberately on September 11th to tie the two in, and I would say maliciously desecrating the memory of the victims of September 11th. They used September 11th as a pretext to pull out of the ABM treaty, Wolfowitz, the neocon that I went to the University of Chicago with.
Mm-hmm.
They used the tragedy of September 11th even to get fast-track authorization for President Bush to negotiate the next round of trade deals when that was dead in the water. So they've used September 11th as an excuse and a pretext to do everything, as well as to gut and destroy progressive social programs.
You know, if I can interject the point you made earlier about how traditional law enforcement is the effective way to deal with terrorists, and that's how it's generally done. I mean, is that how other countries deal with it? I mean, how are we unique that, or do other? What is there a pattern where some countries start invading other countries to deal with terrorists, or what's the historical or international record there?
Well, the only other country that have dealt with this problem by military force is, of course, Israel, rather than sit down and negotiating in good faith with Palestinians. They've just used force and violence, and I say that having been the legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace negotiations. But other than Israel, all other states up till September 11th had basically dealt with the question of terrorism as a matter of domestic and international law enforcement. At that point in time, September 11th, there were 13 different international treaties directly on point, most of which we had gotten on the books that could have been used to handle this matter. But it's clear that's not what the Bush people had in mind. They wanted to use this as a pretext to militarize our society, to justify military intervention into Central Asia and more into the Persian Gulf, where there's two-thirds of the oil and gas for the future economy of the world. This is something Brzezinski identified in his book, The Grand Chessboard. Mm-hmm. That is, we had to go in there and get the oil and the gas, and we needed a pretext. And September 11th provided a pretext.
Now, one thing that has always confused me, and it's certainly confused my students over the years, is that the Constitution, if I recall correctly, and you're certainly the right person to have here to ask this question to, says that if we go to war, we're supposed to have Congress declare war and vote to authorize the country to go to war. That's our protection from an executive sort of taking that power on his or her own and sort of taking off to a war that the people of the country don't want to be in. But we have not declared war, to my knowledge, since the Second World War. That was the last time we actually had a formal declaration of war, despite having a lot of wars. And we're not formally declaring war now on any of the in Afghanistan or Iraq or any other country we're going.
That is correct, Bob. After September,
how does that work? I mean, isn't it
right?
I mean, you're the constitutional lawyer. Is that legitimate? I mean, obviously it must be. We do it, and no one seems to protest. But why do we have this declaration of war thing in the Constitution? This clause, if it's not going to be used, and is there an escape hatch that you don't have to necessarily declare war if you want to have a war that you can get a. I mean, how does this work that we have all these wars without declaring war?
Right. The Constitution clearly requires a formal declaration of war. You are correct to point out that the last formal declaration of war we had was World War II. And yet we see the Bush administration, all of them saying we're at war.
Yeah.
Well, constitutionally, we're not at war. This is a bogus argument. In fact, after September 11th, Bush did try to get a formal declaration of war and failed. He mm-hmm. did not get it. And the reason he tried to get it was that if there is a formal declaration of war, it triggers an entire title of the United States Code that gives near dictatorial powers to the president.
Oh, really?
And that's exactly what he wanted, mm-hmm. like Roosevelt had during the mm-hmm. Second World War. And if you wish to read about this, the late Arthur Miller, professor of constitutional law at George Washington Law School, wrote a book on presidential power mm-hmm. in which he pointed out that with a formal declaration of war, the president becomes a, quote, constitutional dictator, unquote. Mm-hmm. Those are the powers Bush asked for. He did not get. What he got was limited authorization from Congress in a War Powers Resolution authorization going back to 1973 to take action against those behind the attacks on September 11th. And that also, as Senator Byrd pointed out in the debate on this, this was no blank check to the president. It was carefully tailored, drawn down, restricted, and subject to all the requirements of the War Powers Resolution. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, most people aren't aware of that and go along with this militarized propaganda and rhetoric by the Bush administration that we are at war. Constitutionally, we are not at war.
Now, let me just follow up on this real quickly to interrupt you. But it is constitutional to have wars without declaring war then. I mean, the courts have decided that it's okay for us to do Vietnam or Central America or the first Gulf War or the current wars without a formal declaration of war. That somehow has passed muster.
Well, the courts haven't ruled precisely as broadly as you said. The United States Supreme Court has ruled back in the 19th century that Congress could authorize acts of hostilities short of a formal declaration of war.
Okay.
Unfortunately, in Korea, the Truman administration abused this, went to war with no authorization from Congress. 36,000 American men died, and only a generation later did they construct a memorial to them. Vietnam, again, another end run around Congress. And finally, the manufactured Gulf of Tonkin non-event. There was a resolution, but many people said, well, even in Congress, I was not voting for massive escalation in Vietnam. That then led to the passage of the War Powers Resolution over Nixon's veto to try to put some restraints on mm-hmm. this imperial presidency going back to Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. Here, borrowing the imagery of Arthur Schlesinger, who worked for Kennedy. So this is the problem that has been confronting us, starting with Roosevelt on up, that we have these imperial presidents who march us off to war, either without express authorization from Congress, or whatever authorization they do obtain from Congress, they procure by fraud. They lie about it, as this administration did about Iraq, claiming Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which all of us in the peace movement knew they did not, and that Iraq had a tie-in with 9/11, which, of course, was total nonsense. So that's where we are today. My book does review some of these precedents and discuss them and go into the legal principles. And I do it in such a way that it is readily comprehensible by lay people. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand this book and the arguments behind them. Indeed, a good deal of it is based on transcripts of arguments I have made in military court-martial proceedings where I have argued these issues, and by the way, successfully, starting back in 1990, U.S. Marine Corps Corporal Jeff Patterson, who was the first military resistor to Bush Sr.'s war against Iraq, he was court-martialed for failure to obey a lawful order. We got him off. Captain Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn, who refused to go to Iraq because she felt she would be called upon to commit Nuremberg crimes against peace, war crimes, and also administer experimental medical vaccines to U.S. armed forces, which later produced the Gulf War syndrome.
Well, before we go through your caseload entirely, let me stop for a second and introduce our guest again to our audience, Francis Boyle, the University of Illinois law professor, joining us today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Francis Boyle is the author of the new book, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law, just published by Roman and Littlefield to much acclaim, dealing with the United States and international law and what Americans can do about the crisis of illegality taking place with the governing government of the United States. Now, Professor Boyle, Francis, Chalmers Johnson, who's been a guest in this show, has written, is a retired political scientist who has written many books over the past 5 years, three at least to my count, over the last 7 or 8 years, in fact, about the militarization of the American federal government and the lack of accountability of the military establishment to civilian rule, that the basically the military foreign policy apparatus of this country is the link to civilian control, congressional control, is so tenuous now as to be virtually non-existent. And his argument, which is a gloomy one, is that you know, in effect, the republic is, for all intents and purposes, dead. And it's one that is striking to students of mine. I say, well, I can still go out in the street corner and jump up and down and call Governor Blagojevich a bad name and have purple hair and have a, you know, do my own thing. What does he mean? I've still got my liberties. So what do you think of Chalmers' argument? Do you think he's – is it accurate in your view? Or do you think he's, you know, bending the stick too far?
No, I've read all three of his books, the trilogy. The last one, Nemesis, was outstanding. Professor Johnson, as you know, was an insider for
CIA.
For many years. Yeah. And I think he knows what he's talking about. I would not say the republic is dead, but we're going to have to fight for it. And here I speak from personal experience. In the summer of 2004, there showed up unannounced at my office agents for the FBI and the CIA Joint Terrorist Task Force, the head of the local FBI office here, and a guy who had driven all the way over from Springfield, came into my office, proceeded to interrogate me for 1 hour, tried repeatedly to get me to become an informant on my Arab and Muslim clients, which I refused to do. It would violate their constitutional rights and my ethical obligations as an attorney. As a result of this, they put me on all the United States government's terrorist watch lists. According to my lawyer, there are five or six of them, and as far as he can figure out, I'm on all of them.
So that means like if you even try to like take a bus ride, you get shaken
down.
Well,
airplanes for sure. For example, I was a year ago, I was flying in from lecturing in Malaysia into Chicago O'Hare, and standing on the jet board were two armed customs agents inspecting passports, that literally as you walked out the door, and they saw my passport, and they said, you come with us, and they took me into custody. And as we were walking, they said, well, we're looking for someone on the terrorist watch list with your name, but it's not you.
Hmm.
Now, excuse me, how many Francis Anthony Boyles are there in the United States of America? So this has gone on for all that time. And I won't go through all of it here.
Yes, yeah.
But you have to understand, whether you like it or not, because we lawyers are trained to fight back, we are the canary birds in the minds of democracy. And they are going after lawyers now. They went after Lynn Stewart in New York for her representation of the blind sheikh. And she was, I think, very successfully represented by Mike Tiger, who's endorsed my book, one of the great civil rights lawyers of our era. They've gone after Mr. Mayfield out in Oregon simply because he was Muslim, accusing him of somehow being involved in the terrorist bombings in Spain, which was a joke and a fraud. They've come after me. They tried to get Ramsey Clark. They tried to get a guy to wear a wire, the FBI, and try to either entrap or entice Ramsey. Ramsey's also endorsed my book. So they're going after lawyers, and that's a very serious proposition in my mind. So I would not say I know, you know, Professor Chalmers has said the Republic is dead. I don't see it that way. I guess I'm a lawyer and I'm trained to fight, and I train my students to fight. But if we all don't stand up now, sure. You look at all the police state tactics that the Bush administration has instituted here in the United States, again, manipulating September 11th, including throwing U.S. citizens away in military brigs like Padilla and Hamdi, torturing them, which we know they did to Mr. Padilla, a U.S. citizen. Spy program approved by the president and Attorney General Gonzalez, a felony under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, massive spying on the American people. So it's very – I certainly agree with Professor Chalmers on the direction we are moving. Yes, it's extremely dangerous. And this is a point I made on 13 March 2003 with our debate before Congressman John Conyers and 40 to 50 of his top advisors on putting in immediate bills of impeachment against Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Ashcroft to try to stop that Iraq war. And the congressman gave me the concluding argument, and I said, look, the Athenians lost their democracy because of their incessant warfare, as documented by Thucydides. The Romans lost their republic to a coup d'etat by a general, Julius Caesar. And if we Americans don't stand up now, we will lose our republic. We are not immune to the laws of history. And it's very clear the direction this administration is going to go. In that USA Patriot Act, which is completely abominable police state tactics, the first draft would have suspended the writ of habeas corpus in the Constitution. The writ of habeas corpus is all that separates us from a police state.
And what exactly is that for those of our listeners?
For our listeners, what that means is that any time you are apprehended and detained by any type of government official for any reason, you or your lawyer can appear in court and ask the judge to order who's ever detaining you to produce you in court live to make sure you're not being tortured or abused. And second, to examine into the what are the legal bases for your detention. They tried to suspend that writ of habeas corpus in the first draft USA Patriot Act. If they had succeeded, we would all be living in a police state today. I'm convinced I'd be in a detention facility somewhere, along with Ramsey and a few others. So unfortunately, what did happen, Congress did suspend the writ of habeas corpus for aliens in that statute, foreigners, for 2 weeks. And as Professor David Cole points out in his book on aliens, what they first do to aliens, they ultimately plan to do to citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the danger here, and that's what we are facing. And if you look at the whole complex of laws and statutes they've drawn up, basically amending the Posse Comitatus Act out of existence that prohibits the military from getting engaged in domestic law enforcement, amending the Insurrection Act so that the president can put any portion of the country pretty much he wants under martial law, arrogating control over the National Guard directly to the president, even against the wishes of the governors. If you read the Constitution, the republic was originally to be defended by citizen soldiers, today the National Guard, not a standing army. Our founders felt that a standing army would be the most dire threat to the existence of a republic. They did give Congress the authority at some point to establish a standing army. But even then, it was chained in by saying they can only get appropriations for 2 years in a row so that you could always stop it if you wanted to. And this ties in to the requests last May and what is coming up this fall on renewed supplementary war authorization for Iraq and Afghanistan. The Democrats caved in last May and voted $100 billion to continue the war until October 1. In fact, the Democrats tried to make it appear as if this were a compromise and they had no choice. That's ridiculous. This was a supplemental appropriation. All they had to do was nothing. All they had to do was sit on the appropriation. They didn't need 60 votes in the Senate. They did not need a filibuster. They didn't have to do anything. They just sat there, and the money would run out, and the president would have to wind down the war. The same coming up this fall with another $100 billion. The Democrats are saying, well, what? Maybe we'll have some deadlines, or we might have some markers, but we have to do this. Baloney. They could end the war simply by not passing the supplemental appropriation for $100 billion. People have to be aware of that. This is a shell game that the Democratic Party has been playing. And in my opinion, they've been complicit with the Bush administration on this war against Iraq right from the get-go.
You know, I want to talk about that again in a second, Francis Boyle. And I want to keep talking about your new book, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law. But you were talking just a second ago about the attacks on civil liberties in the past 5 years in particular that have taken place since 9/11, past 6 years now. And I couldn't help but think we were talking about that, how when I was growing up in a household that adhered to conservative political values, one of the great hallmarks of conservatism was its concern with not having a government that would be harass individuals, that would do exactly what you were saying governments do. And in fact, the argument that I recall my father making eloquently against the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany and countries of that nature is they had central states that harassed individuals and were constantly spying on them and locking them up and didn't respect their liberties and freedoms. Where do – my father's no longer with us, so I can't ask him this question. But where, in your view, do traditional conservatives who have this strong strain of concern about a powerful centralized state, where how are they responding to these developments? Are you finding alliances?
Well, I came from the same background. My father, after Pearl Harbor, enlisted the Marine Corps and invaded Saipan, Tinian, Okinawa, then went to law school. And I think he would have classified himself as a conservative. We have to understand we're not dealing with traditional conservatives here running this administration. John Dean has made this point in his writings. We are dealing with neoconservatives. These neoconservatives, for the most part, were trained at the University of Chicago. They all went there. The founder of the neoconservative movement, Leo Strauss, I showed up at the University of Chicago right after Strauss retired. I entered in 68. But I was trained by his foremost student, co-author, and later literary executor of his state, Joseph Cropsey. All the neocons went there. Leo Strauss's mentor in Germany before he immigrated here was a guy by the a professor by the name of Carl Schmitt. Schmitt went on to become the leading and most notorious Nazi law professor of that era. I kid you not. He justified in legal terms preventive warfare, the persecution of the Jews, everything you could possibly imagine. Scholars such as myself still wonder why he was never prosecuted at Nuremberg or none of the subsequent war crimes proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
This is the intellectual godfather of the neoconservatives. And I went through the same program with them all. Wolfowitz was there, Khalilzad, Chalabi, Shulsky, all of them. Same teachers, same program, same philosophy. We have to understand that these neoconservatives are really preaching a neo-Nazi philosophy going back to Schmitt and Strauss. This is not conservatism as traditionally defined. I teach a course in jurisprudence and point out to my students that that's Edmund Burke, who supported the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
John Dean has made the exact point in some of his books. These neoconservatives are not conservatives as traditionally defined. If you are interested, there are two scholarly books on this point
mm-hmm.
by Professor Shadia Drury, who teaches political philosophy in Canada, The Political Ideas of Leo Strauss, and Leo Strauss and the American Right. And Professor Drury will tell you everything I'm telling you about the neo-Nazi philosophy of these neocons. And to the best of my knowledge, she had no contact with the University of Chicago.
Well, let me take this out of the academy and bring it to Washington for a second. Back in the late 1990s, you know, let me preface this by saying I understand your criticism of the Democrats on the war and on the impeachment issue. But back in the late 1990s, when Clinton was being impeached and under trial for impeachment, I recall these just eloquent statements by Republican politicians who were urging a conviction of impeachment on then-President Clinton about how important it was, even if it didn't seem like a big issue that Clinton had lied about his dalliance with Monica Lewinsky. The principle was what was important, and keeping the presidency in line, following the rule of law, had to be preeminent. Where is that crowd on this stuff? I mean, that's what I'm wondering. Those people who really identified themselves as rule of law junkies. Like, there's a, you don't bend the rule of law for anyone, for anything, or else the whole system collapses. That was about, you know, Monica Lewinsky in a dress and sort of mumbo-jumbo, lying about that. Then you're talking about stuff you're talking about, which is, I think, on a scale roughly 5 billion times more important. That's what I'm curious about, that crowd of conservatives, the real live ones who say we're conservatives, who were preaching to us in the late 90s about these issues.
You're right. Clinton was impeached for lying about oral sex and oral sex. And if you study the history of impeachment, the test, as our founders saw it, was subversion of the Constitution. And, you know, some people could agree or disagree in good faith whether that subverted the Constitution. I didn't see it that way myself. In fact, I set up a campaign to impeach Clinton for the right reasons,
mm-hmm.
which was bombing Iraq repeatedly, bombing Afghanistan, bombing Pakistan, bombing the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan, and doing the bombings to distract attention from the Monica Lewinsky scandal. I felt that met the test. But lying about oral sex and oral sex, I don't think did. And unfortunately, all those people who said they were guardians of the Constitution and the rule of law are missing in action on this administration that has lied about war, engaged in war unconstitutionally, and is now threatening more war. They are threatening to attack Iran. There are three aircraft carrier task forces.
Let me take off right there before we, because I want to talk about Iran, but I want to preface it before we get into some of the details. When the United States invaded Iraq, the Bush administration made a loud case. The strength of its, not others can determine. We made a loud case that it was sort of based on international law, that Iraq had violated the weapons of mass destruction searches and had failed to comply and therefore had left no option but an invasion. Now, currently, we're getting a similar argument with Iran that it says there's a legal basis for the United States to invade or to attack this country because Iran is an international law rebel. It's an outlaw that's not playing by the rules of the game, leaving no recourse but for the world's cops to go in and kick some butt. What is the legal case the United States government claims it has against Iran, and what's your assessment of that case?
Well, whatever legal case it might have had, the rug was just pulled out from under it last week when Iran entered into an agreement with the IAEA.
Which is?
You can find it on the IAEA website.
What is the IAEA?
International Atomic Energy Agency that is engaged in supervising Iran's nuclear facilities.
Mm-hmm.
It's a breathtaking agreement. And if you read it, if you bother to read it, you will see that Iran has agreed to a work program with deadlines with the IAEA to resolve all outstanding matters with respect to its nuclear programs. That just pulled the rug right out from under them.
Was there a strong case before that?
I don't believe there was. I've inspected the record. I've looked at it. I don't believe anyone thinks Iran has nuclear weapons or could possibly have a nuclear weapon for maybe another 10 years. And certainly it could have been headed off with reasonable good faith negotiations between the United States and Iran, which so far they have refused to do.
How come Iran can't have nuclear weapons, but the United States can?
Or Israel can.
Or any kind. Who makes the decision, okay, these guys are allowed to have weapons and go blow up the world, and these other guys, if they try to get them, can't have it?
Well, right. Let's compare what the Bush administration has done with North Korea. North Korea allegedly blew off a bomb. Now, some people say it was a dud, but at least they tried. U.S. intelligence says they might have six bombs or something like that. And yet the Bush administration just recently gave instructions to Ambassador Hill to go in there and resolve the problem, which they are doing. North Korea has just said we will dismantle our nuclear weapons and hopefully by the end of the year. So we're seeing a rapid resolution of the problem right now. Now, how long that will hold up, I don't know, until they switch gears. Perhaps the neocons will switch gears on North Korea. I don't know. But could be done on Iran if they wanted to, and they're not. What's the difference between Iran and North Korea? Well, Iran has all that oil and gas. North Korea has nothing but starving people. So they're concentrating their fire on Iran. They use the weapons of mass destruction as another pretext. They figure that they got away with it twice before. Bush Sr. did this to justify his first war against Iraq. Bush Jr. did this in 2002 to justify the second war against Iraq. And they figure we'll try the same strategy against Iran.
Let me clarify the point. I don't think I was clear on what I meant, Francis Boyle. The some number of countries in the world are part of the nuclear club. They've got nuclear weapons, and no one else is allowed to have them. But as I understood it in international law and the treaties, and please, this is where I might need your expert analysis, I thought the deal was that the countries that have nuclear weapons, in exchange for no one else getting them, they would aggressively or actively work to get rid of them themselves, so eventually no one in the world would have nuclear weapons. Isn't that the theory behind the deal? Otherwise, how can you say to North Korea or Iran or any or Argentina, you can't have nuclear weapons unless the idea is eventually no one has them? And isn't that I always understood that was sort of the basis of the treaty.
That is correct. The United States was behind the 1968 Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and it basically codified the monopoly on nuclear weapons that the five permanent members of the Security Council had. In return,
in those
however,
five countries, for
the the United States, Britain, France, China, former Soviet Union.
Okay.
In return, the other state parties got two things. One, the right, the inalienable right to nuclear technology, which the treaty clearly says. Iran has an inalienable right to engage in nuclear technology, nuclear reprocessing. And that's what the treaty says. And that's the Iranian position, and they're correct as a matter of law. They also got a right of access to nuclear technology held by the five permanent members, and in particular the United States, that was very interested in selling nuclear technology to the third world to make profits, even though to some extent this would be de facto proliferation or technology that could at some point proliferate nuclear weapons. And then, as you correctly pointed out, Article 6 of the NPT did quite clearly say
Nuclear Proliferation
Treaty that the five permanent members, the nuclear powers, would engage in good faith negotiations to eliminate nuclear weapons. And indeed, the World Court ruled in the 2000 Legality of Nuclear Weapons Advisory Opinion that the nuclear weapons state had an obligation to engage immediately and terminate these negotiations, which they have refused to do. If you look at the history of nuclear disarmament, going back to the very beginning, there were only three good faith proposals ever made. The Acheson-Lilienthal plan,
which year was that?
Oh, that was right after the that was during the Truman administration.
Okay.
Which to get rid of nuclear weapons and put control of nuclear technology into the hands of an international organization. Dean Acheson, Secretary of State, Lilienthal, part of the Manhattan Project, and an excellent plan, which the Truman administration did not want, so they gave it to his top operative, Bernard Baruch, who basically turned it into a program that there was no way it could have been negotiated with the Soviet Union. Second, in the 60s, came the McCloy, John McCloy, Zorin plan, which is still on the books and did call for it set up a program to engage in nuclear disarmament between the United States and the Soviet Union. And the third, and again, I'm trying to be fair here on both sides.
Sure.
The third, of course, was the Gorbachev proposal to Reagan at Reykjavik, calling for the elimination of nuclear weapons. And Reagan said no, he wanted his Star Wars program instead.
I thought, this is all urban legend. I thought that Gorbachev said it to him, and he sort of agreed, and then he walked back. The two of them were talking, and then he went back, and his advisor said, "You nuts, we can't do that."
Well, Gorbachev made the proposal in good faith.
Yeah.
I have this documented in one of my books, Future of International Law and American Foreign Policy, with the footnotes.
Yeah.
And Gorbachev did make this proposal, and after studying it, Reagan rejected it at Reykjavik, saying no, he wanted Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And today, under the neocons, we now have Star Wars, and we have ABMs, and Wolfowitz pulled us out of the ABM treaty using 9/11 again as a pretext to pull us out of the ABM treaty. Again, truly nefarious and Machiavellian what they did.
I know people are going to think I'm hung up on this issue, but if you're a country that was not allowed to have nuclear weapons by the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty from 1968, and the deal was that the guys who had weapons would make a good faith effort to get rid of them. And in fact, the guys have not only not made a good faith effort, their number of nuclear weapons have increased, particularly the U.S. number. If that's the case, then does that treaty still hold legally? I mean, is can you have a one-way treaty? We only part of it holds to some people. The part of it, the other doesn't apply to us.
And, Bob, it's even worse than that. When the NPT came up for renewal, the permanent members made a commitment that they would not attack with nuclear weapons, a non-nuclear weapon state party to the NPT. And yet today we have war plans approved by the Pentagon calling for that type of attack in violation of those principles.
Well, give me I'm confused. What do you mean by that? You restate that?
Yes. As a condition for the renewal of the NPT, it came up every 5 years, we gave a pledge that if the non-nuclear weapon states signed up for a renewal of the treaty, we would not use nuclear weapons in an attack against any NPT member state that signed it and was not in affiliation with a nuclear weapon state and was adhering to it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in the nuclear posture review drawn up by the Bush administration in 2002, and as reported everywhere, and even Clinton did too, we have plans on the books now to attack non-nuclear weapon states.
I see.
So, yes, the treaty is still there. I think because the non-nuclear weapon states calculate better with the treaty than without the treaty. Look what they did to North Korea.
Yeah.
Look what they're threatening to do to Iran, even though Iran is a party to the treaty and has a perfect right under the NPT to engage in nuclear reprocessing. And indeed, Iran has just agreed right now last week, recently, to this work program to wind up its concerns.
You know, Francis Boyle, our guest today, author of the new book, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law. We're almost out of time, Professor Boyle. I would like you to take the last minute or minute and a half of the show, if you would, and just briefly say what citizens can do who are concerned about these issues and want to get active to, rectify the situation.
Well, first you have to inform yourself, which is why I wrote this book in layman's terms, so you can understand what the issues are. They're very complicated legal constitutional issues, but I put it in layman's term. Second, peace movements in Washington, D.C. Ramsey Clark's organizing a peace march on September 15. Dan Ellsberg says quite clearly that he was motivated to turn over the Pentagon Papers and have them published by a crisis of conscience produced by peace marches in Washington, D.C. I know United for Peace and Justice is also having their marches. We need a million people there, more, on a serial basis. Second, impeachment. We need to get rid of Bush and Cheney immediately before they attack Iran and potentially start World War III. The bills of impeachment that I drafted are still sitting there in Congressman John Conyers' office. Contact Congressman Conyers and his constituents. Tell them to put those bills in right away. Third, civil resistance. People going into offices, trying to discuss these matters with government officials and willing to risk arrest if they as happened to Cindy Sheehan, she went in to talk to Congressman Conyers about impeachment, threw her out and had her arrested. Well, we're at that point today.
On that note, Professor Boyle, I'm afraid our time is ending. I think they're tuning up the band to get the next act in here following Media Matters. I want to thank Francis Boyle for joining us today in Media Matters. He's the author of the new book, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law. My name is Bob McChesney. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for engineering today's show. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Today. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
A wind advisory is in effect for the WILL severe weather coverage area until 3 p.m. today. Wind gusts can go up to 50 miles an hour. Mostly cloudy today with a chance of flurries. The high around 29 and west winds up to 35 miles an hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 19. Mostly sunny tomorrow on Christmas Eve. Temperatures are expected to be below freezing with a high around 28 and a low around 20. West winds up to 20 miles an hour. This is WILL Urbana.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Christianity has an image problem, according to author David Kinnaman. Today he joins us to talk about his new book, Unchristian, what a new generation really thinks about Christianity and why it matters.
Christianity was not a religion that's supposed to be talked about as something superior to other people. We're known as feisty and arrogant and polarizing. Instead, we ought to be informed, relational, concerned about providing real solutions. That's a very different kind of picture of Christianity than young people are getting today.
Also, we'll learn how the African concept of me, we has inspired a new book collection. Plus, Sister Claudette Muhammad of the Nation of Islam will share some of the meaningful moments in her life